Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose, but we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Save big on your next painting project at Menards. Pristine Exterior is Dutch Boy's most durable exterior paint. With its rain rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Rob Donaldson, a father who is supporting his daughter through anorexia recovery. Rob joins us today to discuss his experience and to raise awareness of eating disorders. Hello, Rob.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Yes, I'm excited to talk to you.
Good. Yeah, no, I'm excited to talk to you too. And I'm really, really appreciative of you coming on the podcast. I've wanted to talk to a loved one for quite a while. But often, you know, it's quite difficult if somebody's not put themselves out there as a loved one of someone with an eating disorder to kind of say to someone, can you ask your mum, your dad, whatever. So thank you so much. I've got so many questions that I want to ask you. But I kind of wanted to kind of preface it before I start, in that if any of my questions come across as though I'm kind of saying, like, how to put this, kind of like, you know, what are you doing, as in like it's your responsibility, that's not what I'm asking at all, but it might come across that way to kind of understand what you think about it, if that makes sense.
No problem. Yeah, of course.
Okay, perfect. So kind of the first question I wanted to ask, and I want to kind of do this podcast in a way that if someone's listening and they are a parent, it's sort of a resource for them. So I guess the first question for you is, how did you kind of recognize that your daughter might have had an eating disorder?
Okay, so she was first diagnosed in May 2019, officially diagnosed with suffering from anorexia. Prior to that, there had been some trouble with generalized anxiety, some school issues, school refusal, and things like that. So we're already in the system in Scotland in CAMHS, seeing a child psychologist for those sort of things to help us out. So for us, I guess we were quite lucky that we're already in the system. But it kind of started as, you know, there'd be a lot of food getting left on the plate potentially. I remember really specifically, my wife said to me one night, I'm really worried, Rob, you know, she's not eating properly. I'm really, really worried. And I guess, always trying to be the strong one, I just try to say to myself, it'll be okay, it'll be fine, let's not worry about it, it'll be fine, everything will be okay. But you know, really it wasn't okay. But like I reiterate, for us, I guess we were lucky. I've seen so many stories of people being judged not suitable for treatment and things like that. So our journey began with outpatient treatment in the community with meal support and nurses coming out that are part of the CAMHS team to help us through those initial phases, and then we had some family-based therapy sessions as well to kick things off. I specifically remember being at work and having a little bit of downtime, and I started researching. I obviously knew what anorexia was. I probably had a stereotypical view in my head of what it might entail. But I remember researching a simple Google search, and I came across the Beat website and just started reading testimonies and blogs, and it really started to hit home then about probably how hard this was going to be for us.
Yeah, and I think it's great that you were able to find the resource on Beat, because I think it is fantastic, and I guess it, like you said, probably parents might have a stereotypical view of eating disorders. So to be able to have a resource that explains it to you clearly, I can imagine was really useful. So when you kind of got that support for your daughter, you mentioned about family therapy. And I want to ask you kind of how you found that, because I don't know whether you know, but I personally had an eating disorder myself, and we went for family therapy.
Yeah.
And I think to my parents, it was, they just felt a lot of blame. They felt a lot of, this is your fault, which is why we're bringing you in. Mm. How did you find the family therapy?
You know, I started committing stuff to paper so that I would remember at the outset. And some of the stuff I wrote at the start was just feeling helpless, like unable to help. So I'm a police officer, been a police officer for 24 years. I'm used to dealing with other people's trauma, helping them. But then you go into that situation and you deal with that particular trauma, maybe signpost to other agencies, and you leave that family or person to deal with that trauma, hopefully with some support in place. But there's just nothing you could do. You know, as a dad, if you've got something wrong with your homework, I can help you. If you're getting bullied at school, we can sort that out. If there's any other issues, we can fix it. But I just couldn't fix this at all. And I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't know where to begin. And truth be told, I'm used to reading lots of information and being able to assimilate things and come to decisions. And I just couldn't do it. I got pointed in the direction of various books, couldn't read them. I just wanted somebody to fix it. So yeah, I kind of felt helpless. And looking back now, the things I found traumatic at that time probably pale into insignificance as the illnesses are now 2 years down the line. So the family therapy helped me with some of those things that I did wrong at the start. Now, I'm not alone. Just eat it. Just eat it. It's not that easy, Dad. It is easy. Just pick it up and eat it. Or if that didn't work, I would try maybe a guilt trip because mum's crying, younger brother's upset. Well, look what you're doing to your mum. But all those things don't work. And the family therapy helped me with some techniques and some things to say. And over a bit of time, we'd started to sort of level out in the community. And I certainly learned from the family therapy, yeah.
Yeah. It's really, I guess, hit me listening to you, because I guess I've never really had the conversation with my mum and dad about when I was first diagnosed. So to hear you say it is, yeah, it's taken me back a little bit. So I'm sorry if I'm a bit kind of slow with the questions. I guess you just mentioned sort of the family therapy helped you with things of how to support your daughter. And I wondered if you'd mind sharing those, if people are listening, kind of, you know, the guilt tripping and the just get it done maybe isn't the right approach.
No, absolutely, 100% not the right approach. And I've made so many mistakes along the line, and I'm happy to admit that. Mm-hmm. And like you say, I hope there are parents and particularly dads. I mean, I know men suffer from eating disorders as well, but I'm talking about a teenage girl, my daughter, and sometimes father-daughter relationships can be tough at the best of times. Spoke to other parents or other people where dad's been good cop, but unfortunately, in my occasion, dad has been quite literally bad cop, probably more often than not. It just taught me to have a little bit more patience, a little bit more understanding, using certain phrases and things like that, as opposed to just feeling helpless, becoming angry, becoming frustrated, which in the early days was a daily occurrence. But it came from a place of fear, definitely, because you're scared, you don't know what's happening, you don't know how to fix it, you don't know the right things to say. So I would say the initial family therapy sessions over a few months certainly helped me choose my language more carefully, and maybe introduce some techniques to make mealtimes a little bit better or provide some encouragement, yeah.
Sure. What were those techniques that you kind of implemented?
I guess it's just patience, not becoming overly angry or overly upset, and realizing that you're not going to get through in the traditional sense that you think you might get through to a child or your own child as a parent. It just won't work. So yeah, it was just cajoling, trying to be supportive, but it didn't always work. We had a mantra like no fuel, no school. So there's still a desire to get to school. Well, unfortunately, you're not going to school unless you take on board some fuel. So those sort of things would work. But we'll come on to that and fast forward a few months into the early stages of the pandemic, and we were within inpatient care.
Yeah, I think those techniques that you said, especially the patience, I think, you know, it's so hard, but equally, like you said, getting angry, that I guess in a way, that's what the eating disorder wants, because it wants to separate you from the people that actually love you, and then it can pretend like, you know, oh, they don't like you anymore, so now you've only got me. And I know definitely I used to find it really helpful, kind of like distractions after meals, whether that was playing a game of cards or what have you, just keeping that anger out of meal times, because it just gave me an excuse to say, well, I'm not eating it now. And then that anger just got even stronger.
Yeah, well, definitely. You're coming from the other side and you can look back a little bit. But yeah, any little thing I did would be an excuse not to eat. You looked at me funny, so I'm not eating. But I found it really difficult the way that anger was taken out against mum or my wife, because naturally you've got a protective instinct for that family bubble, and it's just like a whirlwind, and nothing can prepare you for it. And yeah, it's one to protect the other people in the family group as well. And you just, I'm not a major disciplinarian, but bad language, things getting thrown, aggression, you know, all those sorts of things. I mean, we don't need to go into all the details, but it's very hard to brush that off at the time. So it's about trying to keep living it. And 2 years down the line, I don't get it right every time. Let me reassure people, I'm still learning, and there are days where I can't do it.
Yeah. I think I'm really pleased that you said, you know, you don't get it right all the time, because I think often people can think, I have to get this right. But equally, like you've said, one thing will work one day, and then so the next day I think, I did that yesterday, so I can do that today and it'll work, and it won't. I guess what just came to my mind then is kind of you said about that anger and things that happen and you trying to remain calm. How do you sort of separate in your mind that when all of that's happening, that isn't your daughter?
Some days you can do that. You know, I'm lucky that we are a strong partnership, and as my wife and I, then we can almost tag team into it. And if the other person's struggling, or just take a deep breath and walk away. But I find that the person suffering from anorexia holds a grudge, if you want, or can hold it against you for far longer than I ever would. For me, the argument's forgotten within a few minutes, because I know exactly it's not my daughter that's speaking to me like that. But like you say, anorexia wants to separate, wants to isolate, wants to blame everybody else. So I know in those circumstances, it's probably, well, your dad's the worst person in the world. All you need is me. It's potentially the situation we were in. So, but like I said, I thought, I don't get it right every time, and I probably haven't done enough reading. But it's just so draining that, like I say, you just want somebody to fix it. So I've been pointing in the direction of the way the books that people know, the Maudsley method and developing dolphins and all those things. And you start dipping your toe into it, and yeah, some of it's helpful, but I haven't even finished the book yet, 2 years down the line, because it's just so tiring.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I don't know, that I feel like the books are fantastic and some of them have really good tips and really good advice, but it's that real being in that situation. It's so hard to put things into practice when there's so many emotions going on as well, of you just, like you say, you just want to fix it, you just want your daughter to be better. I can imagine that can be so hard and emotionally draining to not just be able to wave a magic wand and say, well, there you go, you're all better now.
Yeah, and it really is. And people don't, like close relatives, close friends, when you start to learn, you're still having to educate them. So grandparents, nieces, aunties, uncles, whatever, close friends, why don't you just eat if she feels like that? Well, I now know it's not that simple. So all the time you're dealing with that, and then you're dealing with the questions and trying to explain to close family members, and then you become annoyed at them because they ask silly questions, and why doesn't the person just eat if they're feeling so ill, or they're not going to do what they want to do, and you're dealing with that as well. It's just trying to explain to people what's happening, and they're just in disbelief because they're not living with it, and they've never lived with it. So that brings its own trouble as well, just trying to explain to other loved ones what's happening.
And what do you do in those situations? You know, do you kind of say you don't want to talk about it, or do you try and explain, or?
I think people were sometimes frightened to ask, and that's fine, because sometimes you need space. And other days you just want to blurt it all out and speak to people. And, you know, I probably found it easier speaking to the work colleagues about it, a select few that have, you know, ask how things are, than parents, for example, because they obviously love the person to the bottom of their heart as well. And they're struggling, they're scared, they're frightened, but they don't understand either. So there are days and weeks where you just don't want to talk about it, but in some days you do. You just blurt it out to maybe some people that are prepared to listen, you know?
Yeah. And that's kind of, I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I think it's relevant, so I kind of want to ask it. But that was one of the questions that one of the listeners asked, that kind of, as somebody, so I think the listener might be a parent or carer of somebody with an eating disorder, but their question was, how can they support you? So I think it was coming more from a point of, you know, if it was one of your friends or a family member, how can they support you? And I guess from what you've just said there, it kind of feels to me as though just kind of letting them be a space for you if you need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what's been particularly difficult for us and maybe other people that have begun this journey in the last 2 years has been lockdown and the pandemic, because you haven't been able to meet people. And you feel so isolated and so alone anyway, because nobody else understands. And then with the added burden, you couldn't even have people around to the house to maybe unwind or relax or things like that. So I think people wait for you to come to them because they're scared to ask and they don't really know the ins and outs. So I think for us and my daughter, it's been exaggerated by the pandemic, definitely. I took part in the Scottish Government Eating Disorder Review earlier this year, and I sort of advocated a bit more space for parents to talk, and maybe the medical professionals bringing the parents together, for example, even during the pandemic, in a Zoom session or something like that, because any time we set aside family therapy, for example, like next week, just mum and dad will give you space to talk. Inevitably, there's another emergency, and we have to put that to one side. So really, you were just relying on in the close family on during phone calls during the pandemic. But I really do think that as part of treatment, there should be more emphasis on just somebody bringing the parents together, because again, I refer to BEAT, and obviously the main one. Now there are spaces there where you can join and you can speak with other parents, but you've got to go and search that out, and you're kind of lost, and you just want somebody to lead you by the hand and say, log on at 7 o'clock or come to this location, and there'll be other people in your situation that you can talk to. And I haven't sought support groups or other sessions with other mums and dads just for that sheer thing. It's like, I've got to go to the bottom myself of doing it and finding it. Maybe that's just me, how I've approached it, but I do feel if I'd been down, I'd been at family therapy, for example, and somebody says, right, 7 o'clock on Tuesday, we'll email you the link, log on, there's another 4 or 5 dads going to be there. It would have been something that was useful.
Yeah, it's really interesting you said that, actually, because kind of before coming on this podcast, I had a chat with my mum just to see, like, you know, her insight and if she had any kind of things and topics to talk about. And the one thing that she said was she wishes she was able to talk to other parents, because I remember distinctly, we went to one of my sessions at the hospital, and there was another mum sat in the waiting room, and both the daughters went in for their treatment at the same time. And she got so much out of that conversation. I don't even think they were specifically talking about their two daughters that had an eating disorder. I think maybe they were just having a general chat, but I think they knew that each other got what was going on, and it was just that space to kind of vent a little bit, or kind of, you know, say to each other, it's really not your fault. Or, you know, like you said, you don't get everything right. I bet it would be invaluable to have that space to say, oh, I did this thing the other day. I know that it was a mistake, but I'm beating myself about it. And then for everyone in the room to say, I've done that too. To know that you don't have to be perfect all the time, and nobody's asking for you to be either.
Yeah, and that's hopefully what any parents or carers listening to this will hear from me, that goodness me, it's so much to learn, and I've beat myself up and loads of regrets, and we just have to keep learning. Nobody gives you a manual to deal with this at all. Nobody gives you a manual to be a parent, let alone a parent with a child who's suffering from anorexia. So I've done other few bits and bobs as well as this podcast, and I can't really help cure my daughter. And I don't think at this point in time she's just too ill or doesn't want to recognise maybe some of the work that I've been doing. But it helps me to think I can maybe help some other parents out there, even just listening to me speaking, make them think of, well, we're not alone. And your circumstances are so identical to ours. That's how I feel I can help at the minute. So that's why I do things like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is brilliant that you're sharing your story and being so open, because you standing up and saying, yeah, this is going on and this is how I'm dealing with it, I think it's completely invaluable for somebody else in the same situation. I wanted to sort of talk about I guess we've already spoken a little bit about the support with the outpatient support that your daughter got. But you mentioned kind of coming into COVID and that inpatient support. I've got so many questions to ask about your daughter being in person, so I'm just going to go slow and not get carried away. But how did you feel when you were told that she needed to go for inpatient treatment?
So that, you could see it coming. You could see it coming, and whether it was right or wrong, and other people would say as well that if you continue like this, you will be admitted to hospital. And no, I won't. And the illness convinced, and I know she's not alone, that won't happen. It's scaremongering, it's threatening. But it was the lockdown that really sped it up. So I think I said before about the no breakfast, no school type thing. Well, schools off, schools were closed. So straight away, the person suffering with anorexia is in their room, and they've got no motivation to get to school. They can't see friends, they can't see family. And really, really quickly, that the illness just grasped that opportunity to be your only friend, if you like, and it just went downhill really, really quickly. I still wonder whether, if the pandemic had happened, whether we'd be in the situation that we are, but nobody's got a crystal ball. But it certainly hastened a really quick downward spiral, and it became inevitable. So, there was discussions about this was going to happen, and certain things need to be put in place. Paperwork needs to be completed under legislation and what have you, without going into too much detail. And on the day in question, we went down, and then it was decided, whilst we were there, we took a suitcase, kind of knew it was coming that would happen. But everyone was so fresh. It was April, so the pandemic kicked in March 2020. So we basically had to leave her at reception with a suitcase, with a stranger, breaking her heart. And for the next 3 weeks, you weren't allowed to see her face to face because the world was on lockdown and nobody knew how to react to it. So that was an incredibly tough 3 weeks, just to have to turn your back on a scared 16-year-old girl who thought the day would never come where this would happen. So, I'm not going to lie, that was a really traumatic day, and the pandemic made it even worse. But after 3 weeks, people started to settle down a bit, and they're able to put some practices and procedures in place with PPE and things like that. So things became a bit better after that. And actually, as a result of speaking out about that, not in a negative way, I wasn't criticising the NHS, but the NHS Trust where we're based actually realised that, no, that's not good enough. And we can actually accommodate parents coming on and settling people on the ward now with the appropriate PPE. So that kind of answers your question a wee bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds, I think, you know, having to have a family member go into inpatient treatment would be hard enough, but with the pandemic and not being able to see each other, I can imagine was even, you know, more difficult. I guess, how did you, or how do you look after yourself now? Because I think a lot of the time when this sort of things happens, there's so much focus on the person that is struggling, but equally, you know, for you to have your child go into inpatient treatment, I can imagine every time you walk away, you kind of don't want to go. And how do you wind down or kind of look after yourself after that?
Okay. I will come on to that. But again, I want to say in relation to, and I think it's an important point, there was a sense of relief as well. Sense of relief that she was safe, because she wasn't safe at home. And it should be well looked after, and hopefully people would start to try and make her better. And from a selfish point of view, that myself, my wife and my son could sit down and have a meal at whatever time we chose, with no tension, with no arguments, no shouting. So, you know, professionals will take this time to recharge your batteries, a little bit of respite here, and just look after yourselves. And you do feel guilty for feeling that, but at the same time, there's a huge sense of relief, because it's a daily, daily, constant battle. So in those initial weeks, or if it rumbles into months, you do feel a sense of relief, and you get into a new routine, whether you like it or not, because there's one person missing from the family, but there's not that tension there. In terms of looking after myself, I just kind of, one of these people that kind of gets on with it. Obviously at the start, sustaining, I was a police officer, joined when I was 21 years old. You're used to dealing with trauma, other people's trauma, seeing people upset, death, all sorts of stuff that you become, well, I certainly feel you become a bit tougher to emotional circumstances, and that's maybe a bad thing. So for me, I was able to work right through the pandemic, which was great. Obviously, a key frontline worker, so work occupies my time. I've got two dogs, so a godsend that you can just get outside. They need walk, they don't understand. So on the day you're feeling rubbish and it's pouring rain and you can't get nothing worse, you at least get outside with them and you get some fresh air and what have you. At one point, I got signed off for a month. So whether we come onto it or not, and there was a second admission following a brief period of recovery, and that knocked me for six. And I just can't face work just now. There's too much going on. But that was almost counterproductive for me, being left alone with my thoughts every day, no focus. So for me, continuing to work helps me just escape and be useful to other people. And
Yeah, I think firstly, I want to say thank you for kind of saying about that relief. I don't think it's selfish at all. I think anybody in that situation would have a kind of a breath of, we can just sort of not have the arguments or the stress around food, just kind of eat. And secondly, I think what you've kind of spoken about there with work is so important. I think it's something that people really struggle with, but having something for yourself, and whether that is work or, you know, whatever, I think it's so important, you know, whether it's talking to a friend or, you know, you and your wife having an evening together. Mm-hmm. I think looking back, that's one thing my parents didn't do, was everything revolved around me. And that is so difficult not to do. And I'm not saying blaming them in the slightest, because I think it's so difficult not to do that. But why would I want to recover if the world revolved around me? I think it builds that environment of, okay, now I'm the focus, and, you know, that's kind of what I wanted. But having something to do for you, whether that is something that is, you know, restful or work, so you can really delve into that. I think it's more significant than people consider.
Yeah. And I consider myself lucky that I could do that. We both had time off work. I've had some unpaid time off work, because a lot of other parents have. I saw an article the other day about people taking out loans and credit cards to fund private treatment because they can't get into the system, and the financial impact it has on families. And we've been party to that as well. But my wife working from home, she couldn't get out of the house environment. And I'm just grateful that I could go to work, switch on, I'm needed for the next 10 hours. I'm free from that because I'm so busy and decision making, and people need me. That was definitely a blessing for me. But I don't think I would have liked it if I'd been in a different occupation, for example, and I had to stay at home, or I'd been furloughed or something, because too much time on your hands is, for me, is a pretty negative thing, because it all just tends to revolve around and your mind is just back to the trauma that's ongoing.
Sure. And I kind of wanted to touch on that second, I think, did you say it was a second admission? So did she come home in between that period?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about that kind of time when she came home. Yeah. Was that quite a difficult adjustment to then make, to having her back in the house?
I think everybody's recovery or semi-recovery or little periods of positivity probably presents itself in a different way. And I don't want to delve too much into her treatment and how she responds, because you know she's 17. That's her private life. But there was no. It was just really black and white. It just really kicked on really quickly. But I always felt on a knife edge. You're elated. Mum's elated. Family are elated. I think it's all over. But there were days where you could see that it wasn't, and the voice was creeping back in. So again, that becomes a tense time. Tense time because you don't want to get your hopes up too much, and then you can start to see little things creeping in again that you've already seen before. And you're talking 8, 9 weeks at home, which was great, but 9 weeks between being released, discharged, and then being back in again. So it was quite a quick turnaround, and the second time was even harder. It was just a massive blow.
How do you... I don't want this to sound how it's going to sound, but I kind of want to ask the question.
Yeah,
how do you stay optimistic about the situation?
From my perspective, I probably hide that I'm not optimistic on occasions. I spoke about doing the eating disorder review, and there was only a couple of dads on it. But one of the dads spoke about, he felt like he was the captain of the ship, for example. Being his family, he'd lost a crew member overboard, and there was nothing he could do to get that person back in, and that was just his focus to do that. So, well, you know, maybe a stereotypical dad or man, it's just maybe keep some things inside, be strong when everybody else around you is kind of crumbling a bit, push down those feelings of what's the worst thing that could happen, and just try and cheer everybody else up.
Just wanted to ask, because you said again about kind of the role of a dad as that protector.
Yeah.
How did you sort of navigate those thoughts? Because I think my dad was very similar, and we have a phrase in my house in that if dad can't fix it, nobody can. Yeah. And I think it is sort of that masculine trait of dad fixes things. So how have you kind of managed that thought?
You know, I guess it takes a while to understand that you're not going to fix it. So I think you said as well, your dad took a backward seat or didn't get involved. So that's like putting your head in the sand. I've done that so many times. It'll be fine. Don't worry, it'll be fine. Of course it'll be fine. It's just a little blip. So there's the denial. There's the just putting your head in the sand. There's the not wanting to believe it's true. All these things happen at the start. And it's only after a period of time. You can't just switch on and be an expert and supporting somebody with an eating disorder. It takes time to get your head around it. And yeah, that's dads. They want to, not all dads, and males, I suppose, you hide your emotions, push them down, think about everybody else other than yourself, try to reassure people that everything will be okay when inside you're feeling that it's not going to be. So I don't think I'll be alone in those sensations. But 2 years down the line, it's just the realisation that as a dad, you're not going to be able to fix it. But you just have to perform another role, and that's a role of supporting the people around about you, and the person suffering when they let you in. And like I say, looking after yourself and just being, trying to be resilient. It's a word that keeps rearing its head, resilience, and something that's hard to keep that going.
Yeah.
I'm going to be really honest, it's important. I've thought about her funeral. I've thought about what I might say. I've visualised our school friends coming to it. So those are quiet moments when you just think, and you start to learn, and we don't want to delve too much into complications that can occur, but going back to the sort of stuff we did at the start with a 20% mortality rate, anorexia and bulimia being the biggest killers of any mental health illness, whether that's through suicide or it's through complications, particularly with cardiac issues and blood problems, with electrolytes and things. So, and things like that go wrong, I do worry greatly about it. But then I just try and be the strong person and G up my wife and keep positive from my son who's 14 and has witnessed all the stuff that he's had to witness. So some of the facts are sobering. Some of the medical episodes are really worrying. But you just to rely on the fact that you should be safer in a hospital or unit than at home at certain points along the journey.
Do you think from your experience, I mean, I don't know whether you've got a comparison, but do you think that eating disorders are treated differently to other physical illnesses, despite the fact that there's so many physical elements, like you've just said?
Yeah, I've spoken about this with people and I've never been in a situation, and I know people that have, and God forbid, and you get a diagnosis of a really serious childhood illness. Okay, let us say cancer or something like that. But you get a definite diagnosis and an expert will probably lay out a treatment plan for you involving chemotherapy, surgery, and in X amount of months' time, once we've done that, these are your chances of survival, or you will survive. So that would be really, really traumatic. But you would have an end in sight. There's no cure for anorexia. Nobody can give you any timescales. Nobody can tell you when it's going to end. Nobody can tell you how it's going to end. So it's I think that's what people don't understand. It's just left dangling. It's every day, just what's today going to bring? What's tomorrow going to bring? When are we going to get some positive news? In terms of the medical care, I can't fault that. You know, there are experts there, and when things are going bad, then blood tests twice a day, and your vital signs are getting taken every hour just to make sure you're safe. So I don't know if that really answers the question that you asked, but certainly well looked after. And you do get a sense of relief or comfort that the people are looking after her when things are going bad with certain aspects of physiology. But yeah.
Is there support for you when things go bad?
No. Mm. No. And I touched on that earlier, and maybe it's my fault for not seeking it out and being quite a private person, and just keep your chin up and crack on with it type thing. So like the isolation, you feel so isolated as a couple, as a family, really, really isolated. But like, you know, the support out there, and we talk about Beat Again being the main UK's main charity, but I've just not felt that I can or that I want to go and seek out maybe a support group or something like that. So there's nothing on offer from the NHS, for example, in relation to that. And that's not a criticism. Everyone's resources are at breaking point, finances are at breaking point, so you do feel alone, definitely. But we're lucky that we're a strong partnership and we're together, and everyone's so lucky. I know there are single parents with people in the same situation, and how they cope on their own is remarkable.
Yeah. And I mean, if this is too personal, but how do you and your wife support each other through this? Because again, I'm gonna just speak anecdotally from my personal experience, but I very much had the good cop, bad cop parents, in that my mum was definitely the bad cop, and my dad sort of kind of didn't ignore the situation in the slightest, but to him, the best way to kind of deal with this was, if I just don't say anything, I'm sure it will go away. So to me, my dad was the good cop because I didn't get any
grief. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get anything from him. I just kind of got away with it until, you know, one day he saw me do something and was like, okay, that is too far. And then that's kind of when things started kicking into gear, because then they were both on the same page. But I guess, how do you work as a partnership? Because I can imagine sometimes it can be quite difficult if one of you thinks that the other's maybe not done the right thing.
You just learn. I think you very quickly realise that things that used to cause an argument or stress between you in the past is totally irrelevant. So I could count on one hand the last 2 years any minor disagreements. So, we've been together since we were at school, so you know, we're a good team. And I don't think we could do it without each other. I do this sort of thing, and you know, my wife says, I can never do what you're doing, speak openly about it. But she probably does 90% of the care, just the nature of the dynamic, particularly with me being bad cop most of the time. And that can be hard to take, but I know one day we'll get through it, and we'll look back on it, and maybe, hopefully she'll be proud of some of the stuff I've done to raise awareness and support in another way. But yeah, like teamwork and just the stuff that doesn't matter, just don't let it get in the way. Because if you waste your energy on the little things, then you've got nothing left for the big problem that you're facing together. So that's just the way we've been. I guess that's just the way we are. Maybe not everybody's the same.
Yeah, I just want to say as well that I think, I mean, obviously I'm not your daughter, but I can tell how much you do care and how much you are supporting her. And I look back at how I treated my parents, and I was an absolute nightmare and a horrible person. And I think, why did you even help me because of the way I treated you? Mm-hmm. I am so grateful for every appointment they attended, every meal they sat with me. So if that helps at all to...
Yeah, kind of... No, I do. And I've spoken to somebody else in the workplace who said exactly the same thing as you had suffered. And basically thanks their mum and dad every day for being there and putting up with a pretty awful situation sometimes. So we will, I'm sure, we will look back together and one day regroup.
Yeah, I'm sure. The kind of last question is quite a big question, but the one that I wanted to ask, I don't really think we've touched on it, but I think a lot of the time with parents or carers, whether it's from external kind of individuals or yourself, there can be quite a lot of blame. I guess, have you experienced that feeling of blame? And if you have, how have you kind of navigated that?
Personally, no, but my wife has, and she'll talk to me about it. What have I, or what have we done wrong as parents? We must have done something wrong. But I don't feel that. That's nothing else we could have done. Was there a degree of inevitability about it, or the pandemic made it worse, or a way of coping with anxiety, or, you know, there's lots of different theories out there as to why it happens. So certainly when it's bad times and things are going bad, and, you know, my wife will be upset, and what could we do different? What have we done wrong? But I look back and, yeah, there's things I could do better since she's been diagnosed, and things I've learned. So those are the things I beat myself up about. You know, like we spoke about at the start. So there's things I've learned and things I think I've done wrong during the treatment phase or during the time I've been battling anorexia. But I don't look back on our upbringing or being a small child and thinking anything like that. But I know mum feels like that sometimes, just helpless and what have I done wrong? It's up to me just to say, look, you haven't done anything wrong. You're a great mum. Look at everything that you're doing in the midst of the battle that we're facing. So not for me personally.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's so important just to say that, in that, you know, you haven't done anything wrong. And I think, like you said there with your wife, you're a great mum, look what you're doing. I think if you're asking the question of, or if you're feeling the blame of, you know, what did I do wrong? Where did I go wrong? That just shows a lot of empathy. And I think that shows, I mean, I don't think it's ever anybody's fault, but I think that shows the amount of care. And you're definitely not to blame. Like you said, there's so many factors that influence it. And it'd be fantastic if we could all rewind and go back to the exact point that triggered it. But I don't personally think there is even an exact point. I think it's a kind of abundance of lots of different things that come together. And unfortunately, this is the response it gets.
And it's like the arguments around the dinner table. Don't look back. You just got to keep looking forward. So then it's like, right, let's regroup. That's done. It's next meal. Let's refocus for the next meal. So now it's just day by day. Oh, you don't waste time looking back. And you can have some self-reflection and learn from it, but you just got to keep moving forward and take each day as it comes and try and be positive and just, yeah. So don't look back is my advice. It's really difficult not to, but you just have to take each day as it comes, because like I said, there's no route map, there's no plan, there's no tomorrow we're going to do this. It's just wake up, what is today going to bring? Let's try and deal with it. Well, we've been here before, we can do it again type thing. So yeah, it's about looking forward, don't look back, and just work with the professionals and take it day by day.
Thank you, Rob. I've come to the questions from the listeners. So I've got a couple of questions for you. One of them we've already kind of gone over in terms of what for like friends and family to say to you. So one of the questions was, how can I help my daughter and prevent things from getting worse?
Well, I'm maybe not the best person to ask. I'm very critical of some of the mistakes I've made. So it depends what situation you're in. If you're alone and you don't have the support of the NHS at this stage, or you're in the very early stages, or you're worried about your daughter having an eating disorder, then you've got to seek help straight away. If you are in the midst of a battle surrounding the tea table and food refusal, then from experience, you need to keep calm. You need to work as a team if you've got that ability. And you need to take on board some advice in relation to strategies which will maybe calm the situation down and encourage perhaps just taking on small amounts of nutrition. So I've certainly not got all the answers to that. And it very much depends where you are on that journey. And I won't say don't get angry, because I think it's unavoidable at times. But it's just, like we said earlier on, try and keep your patience. If you can, if you're the type of person that wants to read, then there's a lot of information out there to help you with those strategies. And certainly your local NHS trust, if you're lucky enough to be able to get into the system, should be able to help you with that.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And I kind of just want to add on there as well that that question to me when I read it was very much somebody who wants to fix and somebody that wants to... is putting it on them that they're the cure. And like you said, that's not possible. And I think just to highlight, you know, you cannot do this alone, and you're not going to be able to fix somebody. I think from personal experience, all I would want is kind of a shoulder to cry on when I'm ready. And not for you to have the expectation that I'm sat here thinking you're going to get me to recover, because ultimately, even with all the medical support in the world, it has to come from the person who is struggling. And that's hard, and that takes time, which is why I think you've highlighted patience is so important.
Yeah. And like you say, you can't fix it. And I think I said at the start, as a parent, dad, you think you can fix everything, and you're the protector. You brought this person into the world. There's nothing I can't fix. Well, you can't fix this. And let me tell you, from experience, you cannot fix this. So you need to reconcile that and yourself initially. And like you say, it's the emotional support. It's the love, unconditional love. And it's always being there. It's just trying to accept that there are going to be some really horrendous times. You're going to get called all the names under the sun. You're the most horrible person in the world, because you're trying to make that person eat something. So it's really, really difficult at the start. But like you say, you can't fix it. Don't take stuff too personally, because it's not your loved one speaking to you that way. And just be there. Just be there when they need you, when they want to open up. And yeah, that's just some of the experiences I've had for sure.
And I think that's why I don't like the word self-care. I think it's so, I don't know, to me it's a bit, it doesn't sound as important, but just taking those moments out for yourself and making sure you're okay, because it's kind of like what you were saying earlier about, you know, if you want to go to school, you need to have the fuel. Equally, if you're not looking after yourself and you're not re-energized, there's no way you're going to be able to pick yourself up and go to that really difficult meal and have that support. I think when people aren't kind of looking after themselves and making sure they're okay, that's when the anger starts to come, because you've not got the patience to deal with those situations.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And yeah, I agree with you. What is self-care? So for some people it's going out running or going to the gym, where you can go to the gym during lockdown. And, you know, it's just really simple for us. It's just we tend to, well, daughter's not here at the minute, but it's just get the evening meal out of the way, tidy up, and let's just sit down together and just try and unwind with a glass of wine or whatever, you know. Yeah, it's not, well, I went done loads of running and I went to the gym to unwind and I released loads of endorphins. It's just like I'm exhausted. I've been at family therapy, I've been at work all day, you've been at work, we've had 10 phone calls, I'm exhausted, let's just sit down and try and think about something else. Dead simple for us, dead simple. But you know, I touched on having the dogs and getting out in the fresh air and having to walk every day, even when things are tough and you can't be bothered. So you know, for us it's so simple, it's get out with the dogs, it's make sure we're looking after each other, and just in the evening trying to switch off.
Absolutely. And then the other question, which when I read it, I did, what's the word? Well up? Yeah, well up a little bit.
Okay.
What can I do to understand why my daughter wants to starve herself?
You do not try and beat yourself up about that, because the biggest experts in the world don't really understand that, do they? So it's a frightening thing to have to deal with. It's traumatic. It's when you watch it happening right in front of your eyes, but you'll never understand that. And the person suffering, I guess, won't understand that. Your consultant won't understand that. It's just a horrible, manipulative, controlling, serious, serious mental illness. You have to remember it's a serious, serious mental illness. It's not a desire to be skinny. It's not a desire to be thin, essentially. People present in different ways. But it's a serious, serious mental illness, which unfortunately it takes a long time to unfathom and help the person recover. So to that person, don't beat yourself up. And I don't want to say don't waste your time, because that sounds a bit harsh. Don't overthink that. It's certainly not something that I would focus on, is trying to understand why, because you don't. Nobody will, really.
No, I guess rather than trying to understand why, maybe put that energy in trying to understand how you can help. But equally, I think, you know, you are the parent, you know your child more than anybody else in the world. You know deep down what's right for them and the best way that they can be supported. So I think just as difficult as it is, use that instinct in the moment and what feels right for you.
Definitely, there's right definitely answer. Other things that you can use your energy and desire to learn. And I've spoken about, I'm not the best to preach that, although I have done some research and reading, obviously. But if you want to have that sensation of trying to understand and fathom things out, then there's certainly material out there that can help you do that. And I know, you know, the Maudsley method, we spoke about it, developing dolphins, is one of the most popular ones. And there's so many examples in there of things they can say better, things that can help you understand. So I would certainly point somebody in that direction as to if you're that kind of person that wants to really get to the bottom of it, then you can use your energy somewhere else to help.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Rob, thank you so much. Once again, I'm just so honoured that you have shared your story and so much, many tips and advice and just the honesty that you have, because I think that's just going to be invaluable for the people to hear. So thank you very much.
No problem at all. And I hope it does help some other parents or sufferers just to realise they're not alone. And some of the mistakes you've made, have all made them. And, you know, just take each day as it comes and keep your chin up.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.